Great. Let's put our heads together and kick the fucking lizards off this planet. The Ruhar opened his mouth, then thought better and closed it. Marcellus filled the silence before Bailey could continue. Orban Tal, he used the Ruhar's rank, roughly equivalent to a major in the U.S. Army. Neither side controls space near this planet, and neither side can rely on air power. The current situation has both sides racing to reactivate and control as many Mazer projectors as possible. The Kristang are also trying to take or destroy enough Ruhar-held projectors to create a safe fly zone for their ships overhead. If they can knock back projector coverage over one area, they can bring their ships back and continue to erode projector coverage until they reestablish supremacy in space around Gitanu. We are in a race against time for control of this planet, and General Bailey is correct. We do not have time for diplomatic niceties. The deputy administrator sent us out here because this type of warfare is what humans have experience with. She sent us here, he stabbed an index finger at the ground, because she hoped some Ruhar officers would be professional enough to know when they could use some help. So, he took a deep breath as two Ruhar walked by, carrying a wounded soldier on a stretcher. If you are happy with your results here today, General Bailey and I can fly back and enjoy the administrator's hospitality. Or, Bailey kept his gaze firmly fixed on Orban Tal. Together we can make the damned lizards wish they'd never tried to take this planet from the people who call this place home. Bailey knew from a patch on the right shoulder of Tal's uniform that he was a native, that he had grown up on Gitanu. Da, Tal nodded grimly, using the Ruhar word for yes. He held out a hand and Bailey shook it firmly. Human, there are plenty of Kristang to kill. Why should we? Tal grinned, showing his incisors. Keep them all to ourselves. Beginning that very night, experienced UNEF infantry leaders were assigned to all Ruhar combat teams, whether assaulting a Kristang-held site or defending a site controlled by the Ruhar. Typically, a UNEF observer team consisted of one commissioned officer and one sergeant, chosen for their infantry experience and the likelihood they would not piss off the Ruhar they were embedded with. UNEF HQ thought that fostering a strong working relationship with the Ruhar military was just as important as helping the Ruhar win a chaotic ground war against the Kristang. In addition to UNEF supplying observers, the Ruhar also reluctantly bolstered their thin manpower by taking on humans as security forces for critical Ruhar sites. These soldiers, chosen for their ability to get along with alien allies, were given human weapons and led by Ruhar officers. Even the most resentful Ruhar soldiers had to admit that having humans filling the role of defending important infrastructure freed up Ruhar to take action against the Kristang. UNEF loyalists also took responsibility for another task, cutting off Kristang access to human manpower. The Ruhar were alarmed by Kristang dipping into the pool of keepers to boost their strength, and at first, the Ruhar assigned precious combat aircraft to prevent Kristang transports from overflying Lemuria. The Kristang took advantage of the Ruhar shifting their severely limited air combat strength, and the Kristang's own few aircraft attacked Ruhar air bases and population centers on the northern continent. UNEF HQ quickly advised the Ruhar that UNEF could prevent keepers from joining the Kristang. All UNEF needed was for loyal troops to be given weapons so they could surround keeper villages. Kristang recruitment of keepers stopped instantly. Even with enthusiastic help from UNEF, the situation on the ground was still precarious. Both sides had control of projectors. The Ruhar had an advantage in numbers, but the Kristang had reactivated enough projectors that Commodore Ferlant ships could not safely approach the planet. Ferlant advised that if the situation on the ground turned alarmingly against the Ruhar, he would risk his ships in action against the Kristang-held projector sites. But that would be the absolute last resort. Then, Ferlant's ships unexpectedly destroyed the Kristang pursuit squadron, and combat power in the space around the planet became nearly evenly matched. Admiral Cacrondo swallowed the bitter pill of failure and agreed to a ceasefire. Both sides kept control of the projectors they held, but further activity was halted. UNEF feared the Ruhar would still reach a deal to give paradise to the Kristang until a miracle happened, and the Ruhar found priceless Elder artifacts buried near projector sites. Almost overnight, the planet became a vital resource for the Ruhar, and soon, a full Ruhar battle group hung in orbit. Admiral Kakrondo was forced to admit defeat. And the people of UNEF, trapped on an alien planet over 1,000 light-years from home, began to hope they could not only survive, but thrive, and someday go home. Chapter 3. 1 week after the Flying Dutchman left the Paradise System.
"This sucks," Jesse Cornpone Coulter rubbed his gloved hands together.
"Tell me about it."
Dave Ski Chaika agreed. The it came out like "eh" because Ski's numbed mouth had trouble forming hard vowels in the intense cold.
"I'm so frozen, my jaw can barely move to talk," Jesse complained.
"Me too."
Shauna's voice broke in on their Z-phone earpieces.
"Hey, you two quit complaining or get back in the buzzard. You morons decided to go out there."
"Hey, after all the work we did, freezing our asses off up here, I want to see this test, Shauna," Ski said with a defensive tone.
"We can see it just fine from in here where it's warm," she teased.
"Yeah, sure, on a video feed."
Cornpone would have liked to put sarcasm into his voice, but his lips were so frozen he couldn't manage it. For protection, in case of an accident during the test, Irene had flown the buzzard behind a hill to put plenty of hard frozen ice and rock between the vulnerable aircraft and any flying debris.
"I want to see it."
"See it? Through goggles that will filter out like 99% of the light?"
Shauna's voice had no trouble projecting sarcasm since she was in the warm and cozy confines of the buzzard.
"It makes a difference," Jesse insisted stubbornly.
"What did you say?" Shauna asked. "Hold on a minute. I couldn't hear you. Let me turn down the cabin heater. Irene has it set on tropical in here. I feel like drinking a rum punch."
"If and I wasn't such a southern gentleman, I would say that you are an evil, evil woman, Shauna Jarrett. And you are such a genius for being out there, Jesse Coulter."
Jesse cupped his gloved hands in front of his mouth and blew on the gloves, hoping the hot air would warm his lips. It didn't. He removed a glove and blew on his hand, but his hand got cold so quickly he had to pull the glove back on. It was 12 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit in the Arctic of Paradise, and he and Dave were laying prone on snowpack wearing the best cold weather gear the U.S. Army on Paradise had available. He was wearing 5 pairs of thick socks, 2 on each foot and another on someplace else that was very important to Jesse. The Arctic gear totally sucked compared to the clothing used by the Ruhar. In addition to socks, Jesse was wearing long underwear, a long shirt, a sweater, and a parka. Inside his cold weather boots, cold was seeping through the socks. The thick fleece cap was keeping his head mostly warm under the helmet. The helmet wasn't for protection in combat, because with a Ruhar battle group now based at Paradise, there was no longer any prospect of combat on or around the planet. He wore the helmet for safety, and as protection against the Arctic wind. What was really making him cold, worse even than the gusty wind, was lying on the concrete hard snow. Jesse and Dave had brought seat cushions from the buzzard. The thin cushions only delayed the cold seeping through from underneath them. To Jesse's left, a pair of Ruhar were also lying prone on the snow, wearing clothes no heavier than humans would wear on a nice brisk fall afternoon on Earth. The difference was the hamster clothing was super high-tech nanofibers with heaters and cooling tubes woven in. The two hamsters were happily chatting with each other, snacking on what looked like a type of energy bar. Seeing the Ruhar eating what might as well have been a candy bar made Jesse's stomach rumble with hunger. He pressed the mute button on his Z-phone and turned to look at Dave.
"Shauna might be right about us being stupid for staying out here."
"You want to go in?"
Dave asked hopefully. It had been his idea to watch the test from outside, and now he was regretting Jesse's agreement.
"No, man. At this point, Shauna will think I'm a wimp for backing out now," Jesse lamented with a shake of his head. "I gotta keep up my tough guy image."
"You do realize I can hear you?" Shauna asked.
"Oh, shit."
Jesse's cheeks grew red even in the cold.
"Damn it, I pressed the mute button."
"No," Shauna explained.
Your fingers must be frozen. You press the broadcast button. Everyone in the area can hear you.
To Jesse's left, the shoulders of the two Ruhar were shaking as if the aliens were laughing. Because they were laughing. At him. One of the hamsters glanced at him, then turned away to say something to her companion. They both exploded with laughter.
"Hey, glad I could entertain y'all," Jesse said sourly.
Holding up his Z-phone, he carefully set it back on the private channel that was supposed to be used only by the human crew. All Z-phone communications rode on the hamster network, so nothing human said via Z-phone was truly private. But it was better than broadcasting everything all the time.
"Darn it. Now I really feel like a freaking idiot. Come on, Ski. No point freezing our asses off out here."
"Too late,"
Shauna warned with a giggle she couldn't suppress.
"Less than 30 seconds to ignition. You need to stay where you are."
"Shit," Ski said under his breath.
"Cornpone, next time I get a stupid-ass idea like this, don't enable me."
"Oh, like this is my fault?"
"I never said."
10 seconds. Cut the chatter,"
their pilot Irene ordered from the buzzard's cockpit. Dave and Jesse adjusted their Ruhar-supplied goggles and replied with a silent thumbs up to the two Ruhar.
3, 2, 1, ignition.
The sky was the color of dull steel, sky and distant snowpack blending so there was no horizon to be seen. The only feature to break the monotony of the landscape was a mountain of dirty snow and black rock 40 miles away. On top of the mountain was a tower with a beacon that blinked alternating yellow and blue, flashing a bright strobe light every 7 seconds. The Ruhar goggles allowed the light of the beacon to shine through, dampening the intensity only a bit. Now the top of the mountain dissolved into a searing, intense, thin beam of light lancing up into the frozen gray clouds. Automatically, the goggles protected the eyes of the wearers, and also automatically lifted the protection within less than 3 seconds.
"Wow!" Jesse shouted.
"Hot damn!"
Jesse replied, and high-fived Ski's gloved hand. The Kristang projector they had spent the past 8 days excavating, examining, and preparing had just fired 6 low-power shots up into the sky. The test shots were aimed at targets and orbits far from Paradise, in an area clear of ships. Even at super low power, the backscatter from maser photons burning through the clouds would have blinded the 2 exposed humans. Dave felt a welcome warmth on his face from the still glowing clouds.
"That felt good."
"Stay where you are," Irene warned. "The shockwave will be hitting your position soon."
The first test shot had been more powerful than the others, as the first shot had to clear a temporary hole up through the clouds. Now that hole was slamming closed at supersonic speed, and a sound of tremendous ground-shaking thunder rolled over the frozen landscape. Dave and Jesse lay flat, faces down, as the wind of the shockwave blasted them, grateful for the protection of the ridge they were behind, and grateful the hamster engineers had been successful in reducing the power of the projector's maser beam shots. If the projector had been firing at full power, even from 40 miles, the backscatter of the maser beam in the atmosphere could have fried exposed skin. Projectors were designed to punch through the shields of a starship. Collateral damage to the surface around them was a very minor consideration. Jesse stripped off his gloves, helmet, and cap, unzipped his parka, and gratefully accepted the hot cup of tomato soup from Shauna. After being outside, the interior of the buzzard felt like a sauna. It felt good. So did the hot cup in his hands.
"Did it work? The test?"
"We won't know until the Ruhar complete their analysis," Derek Bonsu answered from the cockpit, leaning over to speak through the open doorway. "We're supposed to get an update when Major Perkins gets back."
Perkins had been given the honor of observing the test from the Ruhar's command buzzard, parked a quarter mile away. According to the Ruhar, it was an honor. Perkins was not so happy about it. Most of the Ruhar project team openly resented humans accompanying them, and Perkins had to stretch her patience and tactfulness to the limit when dealing with the hamsters. Fortunately, she was mostly able to pretend their subtle insults did not translate well over Z-phones, and she concealed her growing fluency in understanding spoken Ruhar. When Perkins came into the buzzard half-frozen from the short walk, she gave her team the good news while taking off her parka.
The test was a success based on preliminary data, Perkins announced, less happily than might have been expected. However, Irene rolled her eyes.
Hmm? Perkins asked.
With the Ruha, there's always a however, ma'am, Irene observed. This is the sixth projector we've been involved in reactivating with them, and every time the preliminary data shows the test was successful, and every freaking time the hamsters decide they need another round of testing, and that second test always shows everything is great.
Lieutenant, I understand you are annoyed at how slow the process is going, Perkins said, without sounding as if she was being understanding about it. You need to keep in mind that the Ruha are dealing with alien technology, enemy technology. They not only have to make certain these projectors won't blow up in their faces, they need to know they can rely on the projector grid for planetary defense. Even a battle group being based here doesn't ensure our safety. The Kristang could attack while the battle group is deployed somewhere else. That Elder power tap and the comm nodes they found make this planet a prime target. If that means the hamsters are being super picky about the condition of each projector, I am fully on board with that.
How long, ma'am? Dave asked.
If the Ruha decide they require a second test,
and they will, Shauna groaned,
then we will be here another 6 days before we can start packing our suitcases.
6 days?
Irene slumped in her chair. 6 days was bad enough when they were reactivating projectors in an ice climate. 6 days of enforced idleness, and 6 days when she couldn't fly. At least when they were at a site with pleasant weather, they could get out of the cramped buzzard. They could set up tents for privacy, put up a volleyball net, sit around a campfire in the evenings. In the frigid hell of the Arctic on Paradise, the six of them were stuck inside the buzzard all day. Six people, three women and three men, living, sleeping, cooking, using one tiny bathroom. That got old really fast. The problem wasn't just being stuck inside the buzzard for 6 more days. It was 6 days during which there was absolutely nothing for the humans to do. The Ruha grudgingly trusted the humans to set up and operate the drill to give the Ruha access to the buried projector. Once the drill created an opening in the projector's casing, the Ruha took over and did not allow the humans even to visit a projector. The arrogance of the Ruha was supremely irritating, especially so because Major Perkins's team had reactivated projectors all on their own without the Ruha having any idea their planet even contained such a weapon.
Ah, this sucks, Jesse squeezed Shauna's hand. The weather forecast is for blizzard conditions starting in 6 days.
If the second test was successful, and that was as sure as a sunrise, the Ruha would want the humans to immediately begin disassembling the drill rig and pack it back into the buzzard. Although the Ruha could take their own sweet time inspecting and testing a projector, they demanded the humans to move quickly with no excuses. High winds, sub-zero temperatures, and heavy snow could not be allowed to delay the operation. That meant the six humans would be stumbling around half-frozen, wrestling the bulky drill rig back into the buzzard. With the back ramp of the buzzard open, snow would be swirling into the cargo compartment, drifting into every corner and crevice. Irene and Derek would have the heaters on maximum power, worried that extensive cold soaking would cause a critical buzzard component to fail. Spare parts were a long, long distance away.
I'm not looking forward to it either, Coulter, Perkins said in a matter-of-fact manner. This is the job we signed up for. We begged the Ruha for this assignment. The whole planet is watching us.
On behalf of UNEF, Perkins herself had done the begging and groveling to keep humans part of the projector reactivation team.
Ma'am, Shauna suggested. There are parts of the rig we can take apart and pack away now. We don't need the components for drilling.
Part of the rig scaffolding was in use to give Ruha technicians and scientists access to the underground projector, but the actual drilling part of the operation was complete.
You are sure about that, Jarrett?
Major Perkins was skeptical.
We've never done that.
Yes, ma'am. It's in the drill rig manual. Shauna pulled up a schematic on her tablet. The hamsters take the drill rig apart sometimes when they want to replace just part of the system for field maintenance. On the mission, the humans had not been allowed or trusted to take apart the drill rig. Instead, the Ruha provided a refurbished drill rig after the team had worked on three projectors.
It's easy. She pointed to the schematic. It looks easy anyway. There's a set of videos that walks us through the process. If we take it apart, we can cut the final part of the stowing process to a couple hours.
Perkins looked at the file on her own tablet. It did look simple and easy, and the process did not require anything complicated. Which was good, because the translated Ruhar instructions read something like, "Being tab A into slot B for making joyous assembly." It reminded Perkins of the Chinese instructions for the washing machine in what used to be her apartment back on Earth. The rig had been designed to break down easily.
"We'll look at this. This is good, Jared. If it checks out, I'll talk to the Ruhar about it."
"Ma'am, if we're not needed here until the test," Derek inquired, "could we fly someplace else to wait it out? There's a Ruhar base only 3 hours south of here."
While the climate at the base was not tropical, it was warmer than the bone-chilling cold at the project site. They could go outside without risking frostbite and death, and they could live in the base buildings rather than being stuck inside the buzzard the whole time.
"I'll need to consider that."
Perkins's instinct was to keep the buzzard and her crew right where they were. The Ruhar did not need humans to reactivate the remaining projectors on the planet. UNEF, through Perkins, had begged for the opportunity to participate and demonstrate that humans could be trustworthy and useful. Abandoning the Arctic projector site simply because it was unpleasant would send a signal that humans were soft, and the Ruhar base mentioned by Derek Bonsu was unlikely to be thrilled with the idea of hosting a group of humans. The base commander might outright refuse permission for humans to land there, even if Perkins offered to set up tents for her team to live in so the Ruhar didn't have to encounter humans frequently. Despite Perkins and her team having reactivated projectors and blasted a Kristang battle group out of the sky, humans overall were still not viewed positively by Ruhar. The Ruhar natives still had hard feelings against humans, who they saw as ignorant, backwards aliens used as a goon squad by the Kristang to force Ruhar off the world they considered to be their home. The real mission of Perkins's team was not to drill down into projector sites to allow access for the Ruhar technicians. The mission was public relations, on behalf of all humans on Paradise.
"I can sound out the Ruhar team leader here. She may have people who would appreciate a couple days away from..." She tried to think of a nice way to talk about the frozen hell they were living in, then settled for "here."
The Ruhar team had 3 buzzards and had sent up 2 warm, large prefab shelters for use only by Ruhar. If some of the Ruhar were not needed for the second test, Perkins could use transporting them aboard their buzzard as an excuse to fly her own team out. The battered and overworked Kristang frigate, "To Seek Glory and Battle is Glorious," drifted through space 80 million kilometers from the planet known to Kristang as Perdassus. Following the Glory's escape from the deadly trap, Admiral Ferlant's Ruhar Fleet Squadron had sprung on the Kristang Pursuit Force. The Glory had been badly in need of a major overhaul merely to keep the reactor and life support systems functioning at a minimum level. Instead of including the Glory as part of his remaining force, so that little ship could go home with the rest of the Kristang force, Admiral Kikrondo had declared that frigate lost with all hands. The Admiral had loaded 2 dropships with critical supplies and spare parts and sent them on an unmanned one-way trip to the Glory, with orders for that ship to perform what repairs the crew could complete on their own. Since then, the Glory had been alone in deep space, outside the typical patrol areas of the Kristang Guard Force. The ship's stealth field was drawn tightly around it. The stealth generator and its support systems had been the first item the crew had repaired as best they could. The sensor field was offline, although that system was in reasonably good condition by the standards of Warrior Kristang. The sensor field was not offline for the purpose of maintenance. It was offline because the Glory could not risk its sensor field giving away the fact that an undeclared Kristang ship was lingering in the star system. For the purpose of hiding, using only passive sensors was the ship's best tactic, for the Ruhar guard ships were hammering the area around the planet with powerful active sensor pulses. Even with its passive sensor network half-blinded, the Glory could easily tell how many enemy ships were searching and where. Every time an active sensor pulse swept across their ship, even from 80 million kilometers away, The entire crew held their breath and prayed that their creaky stealth field generator would keep limping along for just a few more days or weeks. When the crew unpacked the unmanned dropships, they were initially delighted to find that the remnants of Kakrondo's battle group had donated a generous supply of spare parts for the Glory's jump drive. Unfortunately, in order to conceal the ship's presence, the Glory could not jump at all. A jump would create two distinctive gamma-ray bursts at both ends of the jump wormhole. That would be like ringing a bell to announce the Glory's presence. The Ruhar Guard Force might suspect Kakrondo had left behind one or two ships to spy on Ruhar activity or to create mischief. They did not know for certain that Kakrondo had violated the ceasefire terms, and to protect Kakrondo's force, the Glory must remain hidden until after Kakrondo's ships had been transported away by Jarraptha star carriers. Only once the Jarraptha ships had jumped away could the Glory begin its mission. To perform its mission, the Glory needed to do two things. First, it had not only to hide, but to give the Ruhar no evidence that an undeclared Kristang ship was in the star system. And second, the Glory needed to get closer to the planet without jumping.
"Captain, I do not see how we can accomplish our mission,"
Second Officer Smondo said quietly while the ship's two senior officers were enjoying their midday meal in the captain's cramped quarters. Enjoy was perhaps not an accurate description, for the Glory's crew had been enraged to discover that among the supplies Admiral Kakrondo had sent, the only food was survival rations. The homeward-bound ships of Kakrondo's battle group had kept the best food for themselves. So Smondo and his captain were choking down survival biscuits soaked in cups of hot but thin charm.
"Specifically?"
the captain asked as he broke off a piece of biscuit to dunk in his cup of charm. The concrete-like biscuit did not actually dissolve or even soften in the charm, but dunking it gave a pleasing illusion that the captain could do something to make his food more palatable.
"Specifically, as we approach Pradassus, we come within the patrol area of the Ruhar Guard Force. Our engineers have performed miracles to keep the stealth field working. They can't conceal all evidence of our presence here. Sooner or later..."
"Given this ship's service record, I am betting on sooner,"
the captain mumbled over a mouthful of biscuit.
"Yes, sooner. Those Guard Force ships are going to detect our reactor exhaust or the thousand other types of particles we leave in our wake, even when the ship is in perfect condition."
"You joke, Smondo," the captain slapped the table. "This ship has never been in perfect condition, not even the day it left the construction yard."
"True."
"Tell me, Smondo, given that it is inevitable the Ruhar Guard Force will detect the presence of a concealed ship, what would be even better than our continued ability to avoid detection?"
"A critical engineering failure that leaves us unable to perform our mission."
Smondo spoke words that would be considered treason aboard most other ships, a failure to display the proper warrior attitude at all times. Aboard the Glory, the crew had had more than their fill of proper warrior spirit crap and preferred realism.
"So we have to announce ourselves to the Ruhar and be sent safely home?"
"That is better," the captain chuckled. "What I was thinking of was for the Guard Force ships to detect evidence of an enemy ship, but not find us."
Smondo paused to think.
He knew how his captain thought. He ventured a guess.
"The absolute best would be for the enemy to be tracking the Glory, but not be tracking us?"
"Exactly. Excellent thinking, Smondo. The enemy identifies signatures of every ship under Kakrondo's command. They know which ships are awaiting a ride home from the insects," he used a disparaging term for the Jarraptha. "And they know which ships were destroyed for certain. The only ship missing from those two lists is the Glory. And they have our signature in their sensor databases."
Smondo could not yet guess what his captain was planning.
"Our most distinctive signature is our jump drive, but we will not be jumping."
"Correct."
"Then there is our reactor exhaust, although we are operating at minimum power, so..."
He stopped guessing.
"How can we make the enemy think they are tracking this ship without them actually following our trail?"
The captain attempted another bite of biscuit before dropping it back to soak in the charm.
In the days when ocean ships had metal hulls, this was after sails and before the use of aluminum and composites, the Glory's captain intoned in a voice that the ship's crew knew meant he was going to talk for a while on an obscure topic. The poor quality of the primitive steel and the salt environment caused the hulls to corrode, so the crews had to constantly scrape off the old paint and apply new paint to protect the hull. It was a chore the old saltwater sailors hated with a passion.
Yes, the second officer indulged his commanding officer, wondering whether a poem was about to be composed for the occasion. The captain had a reputation throughout the clan for creating amusing, if not properly warrior-like, poems for all occasions.
What we need, Smondo, is paint scrapers.
Mm-hmm, the second officer agreed. There was little actual paint aboard the ship, and little need to scrape what little there was. Color was within the materials the ship was composed of, or color could be changed by manipulating nanoparticles with various materials.
Come, the captain announced, standing up as he placed the remainder of his survival biscuit to soak in the cooling cup of charm. We will ask the fabrication shop to create several eighths of paint scrapers.
And then?
Then, the captain said with the slow, two-eye blink that was the Cristang form of a wink, we will step outside for some fresh air.
As Perkins expected, the meeting with the Ruhar projector team leader did not result in the humans being allowed to fly south for a couple days of R&R in a somewhat warmer climate. Instead, Derek Bonsu's idea to fly south for a couple days had completely backfired on the humans. After the end of the status meeting, during which it had been decided a second test was needed to confirm the projector was fully operational, Perkins approached the Ruhar project leader.
Ma'am, the forecast calls for bad weather closing in. That won't affect your people working down in the projector. But since most personnel aren't needed to prepare for the test, I thought it might be prudent to fly non-essential people out ahead of the weather. We could bring people back in time for the test.
The project leader had been considering a similar idea in the back of her mind. Perkins mentioning it spurred her into action.
I agree, that would be prudent. Would you want to send some of your team with us?
Major Emily Perkins was not yet an expert at reading the facial expressions and body language of aliens, even vaguely humanoid aliens like the Ruhar. She was experienced enough to know the Ruhar did not like the idea of humans flying with them. She also knew the question implied that the human's buzzard was expected to remain on site. Emily kept her disappointment from showing.
No, ma'am, I think my team needs to remain here in case there is a problem with the drill rig.
Very well, the Z-phone translated the project leader's actual words. We will return before the second test, then.
I've got something, the sensor technician declared quietly. It's something.
You are certain? Asked the captain of the Ruhar frigate, Mem Hertal. His little ship, once part of Commodore Ferlant's force guarding the planet Gitanu all on their own, had been detailed to sweep the system for hidden Cristang ships. All the ships declared by the Cristang Admiral Cacrondo were gathered at the rendezvous point in the outskirts of the star system, waiting for a pair of Jarapta star carriers to transport them away. What worried Ruhar Fleet Command was the possibility that Cacrondo had not declared all his ships. Fleet Command intelligence suspected there was one, possibly two, frigate-sized ships lingering in the system. The Mem Hertal and two other frigates had been assigned search areas and were crisscrossing the star system in a grid search. Finding a small stealth ship in the vast gulf of a star system was nearly impossible, so the search force was not looking for ships. They were looking for traces all ships inevitably left behind. Even the stealthiest ship gave off gases from propulsion, from tiny leaks in the hull, from the operation of airlocks and dropship docking bays, even from harsh solar radiation baking off a ship's outer coating. Ships had to radiate waste heat intermittently. The powerful magnetic fields of their reactor containment systems disturbed particles of the solar wind as the ship passed through, leaving a swirling and electronically charged wake behind the ship.
No ship could pass through space or even remain motionless in space without leaving some sort of residual trace. When the planet Gitanu became important enough, the star system would be saturated with satellites creating multiple overlapping stealth detection grids. That day would be a long time in the future. The Ruhar had not yet even installed a strategic defense satellite network around Gitanu. Until detection grids were online, the Ruhar had to rely on ships slowly and painstakingly scanning the star system, their sensor fields set to maximum coverage. In such long search missions, the critical factor limiting the effectiveness of the ships was not their fuel or food stores or the condition of critical components that needed maintenance. The critical factor was the boredom level of the crew. That is why the Memhertal's captain wished to make certain the sensor technician was not merely seeing what he very much wanted to see in the data. Evidence of an enemy ship. The possibility of action and an end to a long and tedious patrol assignment. And the hope of the crew being given a well-deserved and long-overdue shore leave on Gitanu.
"Captain," the sensor tech announced with confidence, "I know this is a trail left by a ship, and I even know which ship it is."
The captain raised his chin and tilted his head back in the Ruhar gesture to express surprise or skepticism, the equivalent of a raised eyebrow. Ruhar could move their eyebrows, but they usually used their chins instead.
"Explain. Show me the data."
"See the rhodium signature?"
The technician pointed to the display.
"Typical hull coating for Kustang ships. Molecules have been ablating off as the ship passes through charged particles of the solar wind. They can't activate shields in full because they know we would eventually detect that power radiation."
"Agreed."
"So this cloud we found was left behind by a Kustang ship. Now, see this line for palladium? Also lanthanum? This particular ship's hull coating has been patched, poorly patched, by whatever they had available at the time, and this ship has a distinctive ratio of rhodium to palladium and lanthanum. I recognize this ship. It's in our database. This is our old friend the Glory."
She patted the display almost with affection. The captain was still skeptical.
"You are that certain?"
"Absolutely,"
the tech declared with utter confidence. The Kristang frigate to seek glory in battle is Glorious had been in multiple combat actions around Gitanu, and during those engagements, the Glory's hull had been bathed by maser light. Ships in combat were protected by energy shields that bent maser or particle beams safely around a ship's hull, or dispersed the intense hair-thin beams. Some of the energy of the incoming beam bled through the shield to be scattered across the surface of the hull. Even with the beam attenuated, enough energy remained to cook the ship's hull and flake off tiny pieces of the hull coating. Those drifting particles, remnants of the battle, had been scooped up and analyzed by Commodore Ferlant ships, adding the distinctive chemical signature of that ship to the fleet database as the Glory.
"No question about it. The fleet database identified this chemical trail as the Glory with 100% confidence. The Glory was overdue for major maintenance when she arrived in this system, and she has been limping along with the Kristang's signature half-assed repairs since then. Her reactor leaks. The trail she leaves in her wake includes helium-3, both raw and irradiated. There is also a measurable amount of free oxygen behind her. She must have a hull breach somewhere that they didn't quite fix properly."
"That ship was declared lost due to battle damage by Admiral Cacrondo," the captain mused.
"True," the tech smiled. "This would be the first time we were lied to by the Kristang?"
The captain smiled and shook his head.
"If the Kristang ever tell us the truth, that will be a first."
"Very well. We will pursue this lead. Good job. I will be counting on you not to lose track of our quarry."
If a Kristang frigate was in the Gitanu system without declaring its presence, it was in direct violation of the admittedly humiliating ceasefire terms agreed to by Admiral Cacrondo. Therefore, the Memhertal and her sister ships would be within the rules of engagement to shoot first and ask questions never. Captain Rostall had 4 missiles loaded and ready in their launch tubes, awaiting only a target and launch authorization.
One forward and one aft Mazer turret was energized at all times, with the turrets being rotated as the active units had to be taken down for maintenance. Rostal was determined to kill whatever ship was lurking out there, because any hidden Kristang ship was most assuredly hostile. Once Admiral Kikrondo's ships departed aboard Jarapha Star Carriers, there would be little to prevent a rogue Kristang ship from attacking Gitanu. Ruhar ships could pursue and destroy the attacker, or attackers, and lodge a completely useless protest through the diplomatic channels. If the attack was sufficiently brutal, it might attract the notice of the Jarapha. The Jarapha might even authorize a retaliation. In extreme cases, the Jarapha themselves had hit the Kristang to teach them a lesson. All of those potential actions would be of no comfort to dead Ruhar on Gitanu. Rostal returned to his command chair and ordered his ship to change course, to follow the faint chemical trail. "Signal the Toman and Grathur our intentions," he referred to the pair of frigates helping the Hertal to search the star system. "What are our intentions, Captain?" the executive officer asked with a knowing smile. "I intend to find and destroy an annoyingly persistent enemy ship that has survived far too long already." "This still sucks," Dave commented as he spooned vegetable soup into his mouth. "I mean, yeah, it could be worse, but it does still suck." "How bad does it suck, Ski?" Jesse knew the answer. He also knew his friend needed to vent. "Before, if we'd all been stuck in the buzzard 6 more days, that would have sucked a bowling ball through 50 feet of garden hose," Dave declared. "And now?" "Now?" Dave contemplated the situation. "Maybe a baseball. Yeah, same garden hose." "If the bowling ball had already gone through the hose and stretched it out, it would be easy to get a baseball through there," Jesse pointed out helpfully. "You're right," Dave said, his expression brightening. "Oh my God," Shauna said with disgust. "Is this what guys talk about when we're not around?" "What he meant," Dave came to Jesse's rescue, "is that if we had been stuck in the buzzard first, this would seem great." Jesse nodded, not sure whether he should contradict Shauna. Unlike the vast majority of human men on Paradise, he had a semi-girlfriend. No way was he going to do anything to risk that. He was on the edge already. "We do talk about stupid stuff all the time," Jesse hastened to add. "That was a Nobel Prize-winning conversation, compared to most of the stuff we talk about." "I can believe it," Shauna agreed. She shook another pinch of hot pepper powder into her vegetable soup. It was the third day in a row they ate rehydrated vegetable soup for lunch, and they were all getting tired of it. "You're right, Dave, this does suck." Somehow, humans had gotten screwed on the whole deal. Most of the Ruhar had bugged out of the Arctic base, leaving only one of their 3 buzzards and 5 hamsters to prepare for the second test. As a gesture of goodwill, the Ruhar had left one of their portable shelters for the humans to live in, so they weren't all crammed together in the buzzard. Irene and Derek declined the offer to live in the shelter, saying they wanted more time in the buzzard to use it as a simulator for flight training. Shauna thought her friend Irene was doing more than simulating certain intimate activities with their cute co-pilot Derek, but so far Irene hadn't said anything to Shauna about it. The worst part of the deal was that at the end of the projector test, the humans would be expected to take down and pack away not only their own shelter, but also the shelter being used by the Ruhar technical team. The weather shortly after the test would be a full-blown blizzard, and the Ruhar would be sure to blame the humans if either of the shelters were damaged in the process of taking them down and stowing them in the Ruhar's buzzard. After securing the shelters, Perkins and her team would need to finish stowing away the drill rig. What should have been a matter of 2 or 3 uncomfortable hours was now looking like it would take a full day, or more. The humans would be working outside in the cold, freezing fingers, while the Ruhar sat inside their warm, cozy buzzard's passenger cabin, eating snacks and taking naps. Any delay would give the Ruhar one more reason to remove humans from any meaningful assignments on Paradise. That was the deal the team had signed up for. Humans did the crappy grunt work, and they were expected to smile and keep their mouths shut about it. Shauna picked up a slice of potato with her spoon. "Dave,
Do you still think this is better than farming?
Oh, hell yes, Jesse answered on behalf of Dave, who nodded vigorously. Way better.
Chapter 4 Baterna Logelia came directly from a very uncomfortable Ruhar-only meeting to her regular weekly meeting with the UNEF Chief of Intelligence. She was dreading what was going to be a very, very uncomfortable conversation.
"Good morning, General Marcellus," she said as she walked into her office and sat down heavily in her chair.
"Good morning, Administrator Logelia."
"General, we're going to skip the usual briefing today. Something has come up. Your headquarters will be officially informed soon. I want to tell you personally."
Marcellus kept himself from showing the exasperation he felt inwardly. For a brief time, things had been going reasonably well for UNEF, now that the Ruhar fleet had stationed a battle group at Paradise. Marcellus had been waiting for the spell to be broken, for disaster to strike UNEF again. Was this it?
"I am listening."
"These Keepers of the Faith among your people have created a very serious problem for both of us," Baterna explained. "They actively assisted the Kristang during the projector crisis. They rejected UNEF's declaration of loyalty to the Ruhar Coalition. Now thousands of them have volunteered to leave this planet with the Kristang. You can understand that these developments have made my people question whether we could ever trust humans."
The Jirapha were sending star carriers to transport the survivors of Admiral Kakrondo's battle group and his ground troops away from the Paradise system. That the Kristang had offered to take their human allies with them when their remaining forces left Paradise had surprised both Ruhar and humans, UNEF and the Keepers. That any human would volunteer to leave Paradise with the Kristang had also been surprising to UNEF. That so far 5,000 Keepers would be leaving had astonished UNEF HQ and alarmed the Ruhar.
"These Keepers have left official military service. We can't prevent them from going with the Kristang if they choose to do that."
"Yes, you could."
"Excuse me?" Marcellus asked, confused. "We could what?"
"Stop these Keepers from leaving with the Kristang. You could do it. You have chosen not to. Even though you surely know the Keepers are making a horrible, foolish mistake, humans who leave this planet with the Kristang will almost certainly be killed, either to punish humans in general or for sport. The Kristang are absolutely not acting for the benefit of humans."
"The Keepers are adults. They are capable of making their own decisions, even if our leadership strongly believes the Kristang are likely leading them to their deaths. It is not our way to force people to act against their personal beliefs," Marcellus explained.
What he did not say was there had been much debate on that subject at UNEF HQ, with many, including Wallace, arguing they should indeed forcibly prevent the Keepers from going with the Kristang. The debate had been heated, and ultimately the decision had been made that UNEF would not interfere with the Keepers who wanted to join the Kristang. UNEF did demand those Keepers remove UNEF and other military insignia from their clothing, which had become a sticky situation. The Keepers were happy to remove UNEF insignia, but refused to surrender their national military symbols or rank insignia. It was UNEF, the Keepers declared, that were the traitors. In their minds, the Keepers were the only ones continuing the mission they had been assigned by lawful national authorities on Earth, so only Keepers had a right to wear military insignia. For now, UNEF HQ had decided not to contest the issue with force.
"Yes, that is one possible reason," Baterna cocked her head in an eerily human-like gesture. "Your leadership may also be thinking you are better off without the most fanatical of Keepers causing problems here on Gitanu. Having them voluntarily leave the planet solves a lot of problems for you."
Marcellus smiled with one side of his mouth.
"You might be correct about that. I can't speak for all UNEF leadership."
"What worries me deeply is I do not understand their motivation. It is extremely puzzling."
How to explain human motivations to an alien, Marcellus asked himself. He wasn't sure he fully understood the motivations of the Keepers, because to Marcellus, they were stubborn idiots who refused to accept the truth.
"Each person has their own set of motivations for choosing to leave with the Kristang.
Many of the keepers.
General Marcellus, I believe we have experienced a miscommunication, the Burgermeister said slowly, taking care to pronounce each word with as little squeak in her voice as she could manage. She checked her Z-phone to assure it was translating correctly. When I said there, I was referring to the Kristang, not to humans who are choosing to leave Gaetano. These humans, as you said, each have their own reasons. It is difficult to accept that your people were lured away from Earth to serve a species you now know to be your enemy. I believe these keepers are unwilling or unable to accept the harsh reality of their situation.
Oh, I understand now, Marcellus nodded, smiling. Although he did not like the alien's judgment on humans, the Ruhar could not possibly understand.
Good. Administrator Logelia returned the smile, showing her substantial front teeth. What I do not understand is why the Kristang are bothering to bring the Keepers with them. Over 5,000 humans have volunteered to go off-world with the Kristang, and the numbers are increasing as the evacuation day approaches, she observed.
Would those numbers decline as Kristang transport ships arrived in orbit, and reality of leaving Gaetano and UNEF set in? The Ruhar government and UNEF were eager to see what would happen. The Ruhar military was concerned the Keepers going off-world might someday present a security risk, although no one could imagine how that might happen.
That many humans, aliens, presents a substantial logistics burden on the Kristang. They will need to provide human food, at least until they arrive at their destination and the Keepers are able to grow their own food.
Maybe the Kristang are planning to bring the Keepers to a planet where the native life is compatible with human nutrition needs? Marcellus was guessing, and guessing on the hopeful side of the unknown. The idea that the Kristang were bringing Keepers off-world only to kill them was too depressing to contemplate.
Baterna lifted one shoulder in the Ruhar equivalent of a shrug. The Kristang have refused to say what their plans are for the Keepers. We inquired, and were told that under the ceasefire terms, the Kristang have no obligation to reveal their plans or destination for after the Jurapta Star Carrier's rendezvous with the Theranin. She frowned toward Marcellus. Legally, they are within their rights. What the Kristang plan to do with your Keepers is not our concern, although I fear for their fate. My question is what the Kristang hope to gain by bringing your Keepers with them. In my opinion, it would be better for the Kristang to leave your malcontents. She paused to check whether the word translated correctly. Here, to create problems for UNEF and my government. The only reason I can think of to motivate the Kristang would be for them to sow discontent within UNEF. But, she held up her hands.
Yes, why would they bother? Marcellus mused. They are leaving this planet. And UNEF is, I have to admit, of no military importance.
I am pleased that we agree, Baterna said with another toothy grin. The reason I mentioned the Keepers is they have caused considerable anxiety within my government, and some decisions have been made at the federal level that I do not fully agree with. As you know, the population of Gaetano is increasing. There are transport ships arriving every month. My people are moving back into villages that were evacuated during the... Well, we do not need to mention that unhappy time, she frowned.
What she meant was when UNEF had been enforcing the Kristang's evacuation of the planet.
What matters to you is many of my people have expressed interest in residing on the continent you call Lemuria.
Lemuria? In territory you gave to UNEF? Marcellus asked, alarmed.
Unfortunately, yes. The communication that will be officially delivered to your headquarters today states that your people will be relocated to southern Lemuria, across the mountain range. The area we have selected is not a jungle like where you are living now. This new area had a climate more like Georgia in your United States.
Marcellus did not immediately reply while he considered the implications. Southern Lemuria was in many ways greatly preferable to the steaming jungles where UNEF was now living. Many earth crops did not grow well in the jungle, and daytime temperatures could be uncomfortably hot.
If the Ruhar had given UNEF the choice between being near the equator or in southern Lemuria, UNEF would not have chosen the jungle. The only reason UNEF had been moved to the jungle was it was closer to the northern continent, reducing transport time and effort for the Ruhar. But now, when UNEF personnel had expended enormous time and effort to clear land, plant crops, and construct villages, it would be a bitter pill for the humans to be forcibly relocated and start over.
"Is this issue open to negotiation?" Marcellus asked fearfully.
"No," she shook her head.
"Many of my people feel that your current location is too close to our population centers and to critical infrastructure such as the cargo launcher. Also, there are commercial interests among my people who wish to develop the northern seacoast of Lemuria. Having humans in proximity would not be good for," she did the one shoulder shrug, "property values. I am sorry that commercial concerns affect relations between our peoples. But please understand that maintaining a battle group at Gitanu requires not only an ongoing search for elder artifacts, it requires a substantial and growing population. To encourage people to move to Gitanu, we must offer business opportunities. The battle group protects your people as much as my own, so encouraging development is to the benefit of UNEF."
"I understand.
Real estate? UNEF was being relocated again because of a real estate deal?" Marcellus reflected ruefully that in this regard, the Ruhar were no different from the humans they deemed primitive.
"Administrator Logelia, I feel I must point out that after the Keepers leave with the Kristang, the overwhelming majority of UNEF forces will be people who have formally declared loyalty to the Ruhar. I also remind you that Major Perkins's team rescued this planet from the Kristang by destroying a battle group."
Paterna nodded slowly.
"We appreciate what Major Perkins and her team did, and we understand the importance of UNEF's pledge of loyalty. General, there simply is not enough trust of humans within my people. This relocation will be inconvenient, however, it may actually be for the best in the long term. Having our peoples physically separated will allow tensions to cool, and it will remove the possibility of incidents that could further damage relations. Over time, my people may come to view humans as farmers who happen to live on part of our planet, rather than occupiers who have been conquered."
Marcellus hoped the harsh words of her last sentence was a function of the Z-phone translator. The Ruhar would be happy for humans to be living quietly in far southern Lemuria, until the Ruhar population increased and the aliens decided they needed Lebensraum. What would happen to the defenseless humans then?
"Thank you, Administrator." He stood and made a short bow toward her. "I will convey your concerns to my leadership."
As he was escorted out of the building, he thought to himself that it was good he hadn't put any effort into replacing the tent he lived in with a real hut. Major Emily Perkins was escorted across the airfield by a Ruhar guard, a smiling, friendly Ruhar guard who kept his sidearm in an unobtrusive holster. Still, Perkins had an armed guard escorting her everywhere she went on the Ruhar airbase. She was allowed access to the military base, but she was neither trusted nor particularly welcome. As they walked toward the administration building, Perkins saw Ruhar giving her unfriendly looks, and one gave her a rude gesture using crossed fingers lifted in her direction. Perkins looked straight ahead, a ghost of a smile on her lips. "Be friendly," she reminded herself. "Don't provoke anything. We just came back from a miserable mission in the frigid Arctic where we helped reactivate maser projectors that will protect this planet. If all the Ruhar on the airbase knew about that, would they be more welcoming?" Probably not. Humans on Paradise were still viewed as an occupying force, primitive lackeys of the hated Kristang. The fact that the local government allowed Perkins's team to fly around like leashed pets was not going to change the minds of the native Ruhar. And while she was thinking of humans on Paradise, she saw across the airfield a group of humans being marched off a giant Dumbo transport aircraft. Even at a distance, she could tell by their dress uniforms the humans were UNEF officers. "Excuse me," she asked her escort through the Z-phone translator. "Who are those humans?" Perkins still had a good pipeline to UNEF HQ, and she was not aware of any high-level meeting scheduled for that day.
"Those," her escort grimaced, using the exact same facial contortions as a human.
"They are, you call them,